All right, so I was thinking about one of the ones that we did last week, just the idea of a friend, faithful to the wounds of a friend, kind of that whole concept. So I thought we'd maybe look at, maybe another aspect of that concept of words and when to speak and when to not and what happens when you do it at the wrong time. So take a look at Proverbs 18:19, and this is kind of the half-empty version of that other proverb, when you have done this incorrectly, and what happens. Proverbs 18:19. Somebody read that.
A brother offended is more unyielding than a strong city, and a quarreling is like the bars of a castle.
All right, a brother offended, or that word in Proverbs is used to, is also translated transgress. So a brother transgressed 23 times is harder to be won, is how my NASB puts it, than a strong city. What's the concept here? What has one brother done to another?
Offended
them, right? And contentions are like bars of a citadel. So what happens when you repeatedly offend another brother or sister, presumably here with your words? What does the offended party end up doing? They put up walls and they're done, right? They say, look, you know, you've done it one too many times or what have you. And that's the end result of words that are spoken in wrong timing, wrong situation, with the wrong tone, with the wrong purpose, with the wrong heart, whatever it may be. But that is often the end result of our words. One of the things that I have, and I've shared this with you guys, I think on multiple occasions, but that is one of my, as a persister, and maybe not even just a persister, but maybe it's just a fellow sinner, I struggle with my tone in the way I say things. If I had a quarter for every time growing up, my mom said, Mike, it's not what you said, but how you said it. And it's consistent in my marriage. I get it all the time. And that is one of the things I constantly have to be aware of, or I'll just speak harshly, and I don't mean it at an 8, I mean it at a 4, but it's heard as an 8, right, on a scale of 1 to 10. And I can come across much more stern or frustrated or angry than I really am, but the way it comes out of my mouth just doesn't line up with what's in my heart. Now, that doesn't excuse me if those are my words, and I'm responsible for what comes out of my mouth, so it's not like I can rationalize and say, well, I meant to, and I try to do that sometimes, it doesn't work very well. But it's still ultimately my responsibility. And I have to be really careful with this with my kids, right? Some of my kids are like brick walls and, man, they don't care and whatever, it bounces off of them. Some of my kids are like big sponges. And because of their high harmonizers, boy, if I look at them cross, I mean, they like melt in a puddle right there. Like, oh, God, Daddy's mad at me. You know, like, oh, boy. So I have learned this the hard way many times and, frankly, still do. So something just to be mindful of, if you have tendencies to, in your words, offend people, right? You get one chance to do that, and you can't take those back, right? You guys have heard the illustration of maybe a parent trying to teach their kid kind of the power of words and what they do. Dad took a pillow in the backyard, a feather pillow, and shook it out, right? And said, that's what happens when you get your words. And kid was like, you know, when you spread your words, they spread like flower feathers or whatever everywhere. And he said, but in forgiveness, you know, you can try to get them all back, right? And then you try to get all the feathers back, and it's pointless. Or nailing nails in a fence, right? You can pull the nail out, but the damage is still done. There's still a hole, and our words are very similar. So be cognizant of that, right? Sometimes as Christians, we have that idea that biblically we're supposed to speak, right, the truth, and we forget the in love part, right? Well, we're Christians, so we're called to share the gospel, called to share hard things, and that's true. But the in love part is a important balance always to that delicate dance that we're supposed to do as believers, especially when we're dealing with humans. Okay, and oftentimes even folks that you would feel like, man, they're not really offended by what I would say. Some folks have been so deeply pained in their past by words or by other people. They've just erected walls in their life and they put on a facade of being hard so they don't have to deal with their feelings and what have you. So even some of the most, what you would presume are calloused human beings, really aren't. They are people that have been wounded, and in order to not get re-wounded, they put up bars so they don't have to go through that process again. Okay? So that concept of speak your mind, right, is not a biblical concept. It is mark of a fool in Scripture. So remember that as you guys are delivering your words. They are shells that contain great things. And if you do those improperly, the message gets lost, and all that they feel is the delivery and the impact of what you say, regardless of what the content of your words may be. Okay, so struggle with that as I do, and continue to remember that, okay? Lest you have lots of friends that erect bars in your life and wonder why no one wants to talk to you. So, all right. Thoughts on that? Any other fellow strugglers or people that can relate or been on the receiving end of harsh words, maybe in the office about how you dress or something like that?
I struggle with this.
You see, yeah, your walls are up. I'm sorry, Jane. Jane and I have a teasing relationship about each other's outfits. I felt bad about that this morning, just for a moment. It was really short and fleeting, and I stopped feeling bad about it. So, anyway. I was giving Jane grief the other day about her headband, and I forgot to tell her that she actually looked nice that day, and she did. So, you looked nice the other day. I wanted to tell you that. After I made fun of your rainbow headband. So, there you go. I feel better. Dang it, I just wasted all my harmonizer today. Stink. I hope I get it back by Valentine's Day. Tony, sorry. Easy to be that way, right?
Apologize
in advance.
I'm a little late, but still.
People with knife wounds in their back. Yes, ma'am.
How do you reconcile that? Like, if it's happened to you, or if you know you've accidentally said something to somebody, how do you make that? I mean, because you can say I'm sorry, but it's not always taken.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's hard, right? Especially when it's repeated. It can be difficult. My wife is very patient with me because she doesn't struggle with this. She does not have there's just not a harshness to her words. So she empathizes for me, but does not, she sympathizes, but not empathizes. That's what it is. So it's just a different struggle. For her, maybe to, you know, she has learned that she trusts my heart in the process, even though what comes out of my mouth is not always said the way it needs to be. And she will gently remind me because she knows that she assumes I'm trying to be teachable most of the time, sometimes. So she's been very gracious. So I think part of our role is to help people understand. My wife will say things in a way that helps me understand, look, I know you didn't mean that. This is how it comes across, though. So I trust that you didn't mean to say it like this, but boy, that's how it sounded. So, and we try to, in our marriage, keep a lot of humor in it. So we'll joke about it in a way that is, so it just takes some of the seriousness out of it, right? So in a way that's helpful and growing. But so she doesn't let it go. Like, she doesn't ignore it. So that would be the hurtful thing, is for her to direct bars and say, the heck with you. So I'm done talking to you because you're a jerk. So she will remind me gently and trust my heart, I think, in the midst of it. And I've got to be working on it, or it just doesn't get received well. So, and I think for me on that side of things too, I've got to be quick to apologize when I've done it. So, but ignoring it always ends up poorly on both sides, right? Because the offender never gets better. The offendee never gets forgiveness, or never feels healing in the process, because no one ever apologized for what they said. So not dealing with it is never a good idea. So now you've got to figure out at what level, like, you're truly offended and hurt, and to know when to deal with that. But those are why interpersonal conflicts are so difficult. So, yeah. And oftentimes, like in my case, I don't even know. Like, I'm just completely oblivious. Like, really? Why are you on the floor crying? Because of what you said. Really? Yeah. Oh. Like, I mean, I'm just stupid. So, sometimes it takes someone bringing it to my attention to say, listen, I know, like, it's unbelievable that you don't see this. However, right, there's this large 2x4 in your eye like this that you don't notice. And I go, oh, got it. Thanks. So, anywho, so for what it's worth. Any more thoughts?
I know sometimes I can say, like, the words are right, but it comes out with the tone that I didn't plan. But I usually realize it, like, right away, and I'll be like, oh, I'm really sorry, that's not how I meant to say it.
Wow.
And it's, you know, when I recognize it immediately and apologize immediately, people are like, okay, yeah. They move on.
Can you teach me how to do that? That'd be great.
Because the harmonizer comes out.
See?
After my first sister already took over.
Yeah, my harmonizer's dead. I buried it.
All the time, yes.
My harmonizer's up in the attic. I killed it.
Yeah. It's weird how sometimes it just comes out of your tongue that I'm meaning.
Yep.
It's like, what just happened there? I don't even...
Yep. Oh. Yep. Happens to the best of us, right? So keep struggling and let God sanctify you in the midst of that, so as he has me. So there you go. It will never, ever go away. So be the struggle is always there. Hopefully it gets better, but yeah, that is just part of my wiring and a lot of you as well. So, all right. Fabulous. All right. Old Testament, shall we? I guess we're still in the Old Testament. That wasn't old. Joshua. We'll give you guys a refresher. How about that? Yes. We're in chapter 8. You guys don't remember? No? None of that? Wow. All right. We'll start over then. Fine. All right. Let me pray for us, and then we will dive into Joshua. Lord, we come again just eager and excited, hopefully, in the midst of a long year thus far. I just think of the journey that we have ahead of us. God, the fun, what's coming with Israel, and Lord, everything else. Just pray, Father, for our souls, our hearts, and just our energy levels. God, keep us sustained in the midst of life as we're dealing with jobs and money and stuff and just stresses and just everything that happens in the midst of life, God. And this becomes, honestly, just a grind after a while, getting up early and trying to continue to be faithful, God. And I'm grateful for these folks that have continued on, that have shown perseverance and are pushing through difficulty. Lord, I pray that you would reward them greatly, that this would continue to be a season of life change, that you would buoy their spirits, that you would encourage them in the midst of their time with you, that their faith would be strengthened, that their relationship with you would continue to grow and flourish. And God, I pray the same for me as well as the teacher, that you would continue to just buoy my spirits, and that you would continue to, and God, all of us, help us to grow closer to you. So for this time, we're grateful. Pray that you would teach us through Joshua this morning and Israel, and Lord, all that you were doing in their lives thousands of years ago. Pray that it would hit home even today. We love you. In Christ's name, amen. Speaking of encouragement, I forgot to tell you guys, I got a message from a former resident that went to Israel and said, I want to help pay for their trips. So it's not a ton, but you guys will be receiving a credit to all of your accounts. So just the trip for this individual was so life-changing that they felt they wanted to give back to you guys and just help towards that trip. So again, it's not going to pay for your whole trip, and it is desired to be anonymous as to who was the donor. But I was just very encouraged, and hope you are as well, that this trip means that much to this individual, that they want you to experience that bad, that they are willing to go above and beyond and give to you guys.
Brad made it sound like if not enough people sign up, we don't go. Is that true?
If we don't hit 30, we don't go. It's postponed indefinitely until we get 30 people. So yeah, so keep that in mind. Now, every year it's like this, so don't panic, okay? So every year we're low on signups. We were lower than this, I think. Maybe not lower than this because we had a few more residents. But we were at like 20 last year up until March. And then Brad said something about it one day, and everybody's like, oh, I want to go. But most people don't make plans for June and September, you know, so they start thinking about the new year and what's coming and vacation schedules, and so it starts to hit. So, yes, minimum trip is 30. We need 48 because we take 4 teachers and size of the bus and just everything included. We need 48, and honestly, 54 is better because that's a full bus. So it just works that way. So, yes, but they will not take us without 30. So we have 16, maybe 18, depending on kind of where we're at, grand scheme of things. So we need some folks. And again, the philosophy at the well, just to guys, we get bombarded with people that want to, hey, can you have Brad talk about this from the pulpit and have him sell my cookies and, you know, can we do this bake sale? And right, we get hundreds of requests. We can't announce everything. The best way, hands down, as Brad mentioned last week, is you guys saying, man, I'm going. Would you consider coming with me? I know it's a lot of money, you know, whatever it may be, but again, that's how people are going to come. So the more you can invite folks, right, the better. So as you guys get your feelers out there and are talking to folks, just keep that in mind. So don't panic over that. Okay, I don't want you guys concerned. Okay, every year God works it out. He's good, and he tends to do that. And I'm sure the same is going to happen this year. And if he doesn't, we'll just spend all your money on hummus and go have a big party or something. So tease him. So, okay, so don't panic, okay? It will come through. You'll get it all back, or you can just leave it in there. And so we had a guy that couldn't go last year, so he's going to go this year with us. So it was money to send an account. And so, yeah. Okay, so that's every now and again you get weird things. We had a gal that got sick at the airport. Like, throwing up sick at the airport. We're in Fresno. You know, she's like, I'm not getting on a 24-hour flight with, you know, the vomit comet. Like, get out of here, right? So it happened. So, yeah, so she got her money refunded. Part of your fees. Did you see that sensitive side of me? See? Yeah. Uh-huh. Feel my words, how soothing they were, gentle. We include in the price of the trip insurance for those reasons. So just in case, you know, we had a oddly enough, we've had them every year. We had a guy that went outside to go fix his hot water heater the night before. Pilot went out, you know, leans down to go relead his hot, and then click, 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 boom, and in his face. So second-degree burns. Totally fine, great dude, but like that was 12 hours before our plane flight left. Hey, Dad, we're out of hot water. Okay, you know. And then, so, it happens, unfortunately. So, don't expect any of those things for you guys. But so, if you get a call to fix a hot water heater on June 19th, ignore it. 20th or whatever day it is, okay? Just tell them to call the plumber. I'm going to Israel, so, all right? No, it's not. It's depending on which way we go, I can't even remember how we're doing it. So, yeah.
We're driving to LA?
Yeah.
In like a bus or like individual?
Individual. We'll go over all that with you guys. We'll take some time to walk through all that. You're responsible to get to LA on your own, however you want to get there. If you want to fly, great, but it's not included in the price. Most people carpool and go down there, leave a car, or, you know, somebody's uncle. It's like, oh, yeah, come get the van and we'll take eight of you or whatever, okay? And then you never know. You got an uncle with a van, then you can go. And then from LA, we usually either fly to Philly, or we fly last year we flew from LA to Istanbul, Turkey, and then Turkey into Israel. So it just depends on who we're going with, what carrier, how they work. So there are some direct flights from LA to Israel. They're just more money, so it just depends if we can make it all work out. So we try to get the easiest. So, but yeah, it's a 12-13 hour flight. It's just long.
Without layovers?
No, in the air. In the air. So yeah, it's like, okay, so I've watched, you know, Fast and the Furious again, or, you know, or whatever. So it's a long flight, but yep. We'll teach you about sleep aids and all that fun stuff as we get closer. So yeah, we'll cover all that with you guys. So we'll make sure you're prepped and ready to go. Okay. How do we get there? Joshua, speaking of travel, let's watch the Israelites travel into the Promised Land. All right, so Joshua, success is the big theme of the book, right? We talked about this a little bit last time, but since you guys are clearly remember my great teachings, I will review this for you, okay? If you want just a quick, again, outline of Joshua, first five chapters are about preparation to conquer. They're getting ready to go into the Promised Land. So 1 through 5, preparation to conquer. 6 through 12 are the battles, okay? The conquest itself, right? Joshua is going to go in. He's going to split the Promised Land in the middle. So they're going to cut off basically the north from the south going into the middle. They're going to defeat everyone in the south, and then they're going to go defeat everyone in the north. And by chapter 12, they're done, okay? That's the battles. 13 through 22 is the dividing of the land, okay? We're going to assign the tribes their land given by God. So 13 through 22, sorry, I said 12. 13 through 22 is dividing of the land, okay? In the last two chapters, 23 and 24, are Joshua's swan song, his parting words, okay? So 1 through 5, preparation to conquer. 6 through 12, conquest. 13 through 22, dividing of the land. And then 23 through 24 are the parting words of Joshua, okay? Again, we're going to see him fight 31 battles. They're going to go 31-0 with one do-over, okay? We will look at that this morning, I think, depending on how quickly we go. So maybe not, okay? So that's the idea, all right? So chapter 1, you guys remember, we kind of looked at this a little bit last week. We saw the theme. What was the key to victory just like it was in Deuteronomy? Obey, right? That's the idea, obedience. And God's going to do some crazy, weird stuff to remind the Israelites, this has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with your battle skills, with your savvy and knowledge and great tools that you have for warfare. Okay, he's going to remind them, the battle is mine, you obey me, and this will get taken care of. Okay, so God is Like, boy, he puts these people to the faith test in a major way, okay? So chapter 1, we see Joshua step up and lead. We see the promise given to Moses continue. So even though that Moses is now dead and buried somewhere by God, the promises that were given to the Israelites continue to them through Joshua. We see Joshua and 10 and following come up with a battle plan. They're going to kind of set up camp, get ready for 3 days, and then they're going to go. He reminds the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh on the east side of the Jordan, hey, you promised Moses you would come fight, so quit building sheep pens, and you're going to come fight when we're ready to go. Okay, so that was ultimately chapter 1. Those guys promised to obey. Okay, then in chapter 2, Joshua's going to do what he's done before, or what he maybe was a part of, I should say, before. He's going to go find out what this land looks like. Okay, so chapter 2 is the story of Rahab. You guys have heard it before, fascinating stories. We kind of look through it through the lenses now of where we have been on this journey, okay? So chapter 2, verse 1, let's pick up there, and let's watch now this interaction that these spies have with Rahab the harlot. 2, verse 1.
Then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent 2 spies from Shittim. Go look over the land, he said, especially Jericho. So they went and entered the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there.
All right, so Joshua sends out 2 spies. Why 2? Why would you think?
Did 2 good ones? Oh, because there were only 2 good ones.
Right, so they sent out 12, 10 were bad, 2 were good. Joshua says, let's just send 2 this time. Okay, so he sends 2 guys out to go spy out this place called Shittim. Okay, one of my buddies in Texas had an unfortunate mispronunciation of that word. I'll let you use your imagination. Boy, at 6 in the morning, he was doggone funny. So anyway. When we were in my residency year. So he had that real thick draw. Like, oh, buddy. Like, you made that last as long as you possibly could, didn't you, right? Anyway, so the IMs in Israel are all Eames. So Shittim is how that is pronounced, okay? So, Jane, well done. Mas or menos. It could have gone a lot worse than that. So, and they meet Rahab, okay? You guys know this gal. So Rahab, we're going to find out, is a harlot. She is a Canaanite, and she lives in the wall. Okay, this was common in cities that there were actually like places to live in the city wall. Okay, so you would this wasn't like a cinder block wall that we have that's 6 inches thick that separates the street from the street. Okay, these are sometimes huge walls that would be as big as this room, right? That would be erected around the city. You could live in them, put supplies in them. Again, business was done at the gates of the wall. So they were these big, elaborate structures that were used, obviously, to keep people in, to keep people out, that sort of thing. Okay, so this is where this gal lives. Okay, so she meets these men who rolled into Jericho. Verse 2, keep going there. Now remember, everyone in the land is an enemy of Israel, right? Everybody. So Israel's coming in to take their land. They know this, right? So the king of Jericho finds out about this somehow, and Rahab is found to be, or is assumed to be with them. He gets a report that these men have come into her house, okay? But the woman, verse 4, who had taken the 2 men and hid them inside, said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they came from. It came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. I do not know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for you will overtake them." Okay? So what does Rahab do to the king of Jericho? She bold-faced lies to him, right? Oh, yeah. They came in. I didn't know where they're from. At nightfall, when it was time to go, they left. And they went that way. So you should go run after them. Okay? So there's a couple instances in the scriptures where lies are honored, I guess I should say. Okay, this is certainly the exception to the rule, so don't take this to mean that God is a big fan of our lying. But she deceives this king, and in the meantime, verse 6, we find out what actually happened to them. All right, so if you guys have seen like roof structures in Israel, okay, they would build their roofs with these huge, like, think Bear Grylls in the wilderness. You would take like these big whatever structures of leaves that you would have, and you would pile them on top of one another, okay, and you would layer them. You would start at the bottom and work your way up so the water would drain off. Okay, so you had these huge just piles of like what looked like leaves and debris or whatever that were purposeful and ultimately held out water. Okay, so they just literally climbed up underneath those, so probably not real comfortable, but great for hiding. Okay, so they're literally hiding on the roof underneath these sheaves of flax or whatever they were. Okay. So the men, verse 7, pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as they were gone pursuing them, she shut the gate. Okay, so these men that had come now to take the spies believe the story that Rahab tells. They leave and now go pursue the men. And now the men that came in, the spies from the hand of Joshua, are now there to have a conversation with Rahab. And what she says is fascinating. Okay, let's see. Verse 9, this is what she says. Now, so what's the condition of the people? What do they know? God's about to give you this land, right? It's yours, okay? Where are they emotionally? They're done. I mean, the battle's already been won, like the pregame. These people are so intimidated by Israel. And they mention two things in verse 10 that have them completely freaked out. All right, so the two events are the drying up of the Red Sea, which, by the way, how long ago was that? 40 years. And then Sihon and Og, which was like last week, right? So they take the two bookends, the idea being we heard about God's interaction with you guys at the beginning and what you did most recently, and the idea is everything in between. Like, those stories have reached us, and you got to think this is probably a little bit of, it's not Paul Bunyan and the ox, if you will, because this is true. These are major events, but can you imagine how these people have told these stories around the campfire? This is their cable, right? This is their news at the end of the night. These people are on our doorstep now. This is what their God has done. He parted the Red Sea. Like, they're wigging out, okay? So you see how God has prepared the people as a whole, but you also see what's happening within Rahab, right? She's a harlot. She's a Canaanite, and she says, our hearts are melting before you. I have heard news of your God, what he has done in his power, and now you're here to tell me about him. Okay, so she's in this like literally pre-conversion state. Like her heart is ready. She is softened to the things of God, if you will, and she wants to, in a sense, give her life to the God of the Israelites. Like she's believing in these stories and needs kind of help to take the next step. Okay. Verse 11, when we heard it, our hearts melted and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and heaven on earth. Now remember, this is a Canaanite who worships other gods, who has just declared that Israel's God is the God, okay? And again, your God, so she hasn't kind of fully assimilated that into her life, but she has this faith, she has this belief. She clearly is a believer in Yahweh, but she just hasn't figured out how to put it all together yet, okay? Now 12, this is what she asks for.
Now then, please swear to me by the Lord that you will show kindness to my family because I have shown kindness to you. Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters, and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death.
All right, so she realizes what's coming, right? So it's inevitable. And she asks the spies, will you deal kindly? I've dealt kindly with you. Will you do the same to me? Any idea what that word kindly would be in the Hebrew? We've talked about it before. It's hesed, okay? Will you give me unmerited favor? Will you give me what I don't deserve? I have given you what you don't deserve. Protection. You were my enemy, and I saved your life just now, right? And had I not stepped in on your behalf, King of Jericho would have killed you. I gave you unmerited favor. I understand what that means, and I'm asking for the same for you, right? For on my behalf, from you, okay? So she gets grace, right? I can do nothing to deserve this. I haven't earned this. I'm asking you to give to me what I don't deserve. So kind of this cool picture again of conversion. And she knows that their lives are going to be taken, both hers and her family's, if these spies don't do something, okay? And these spies respond in a pretty cool way. The men said to her in verse 14, "Our life for yours. If you do not tell this business of ours, and it shall come about when the Lord gives us the land, that we will deal kindly and faithfully with you." So idea being, absolutely, okay? Our life for yours. We had an exchange. You saved our lives. We will save now your life and your family's life. We will give you, verse 14, kindness or hesed, just as you have asked, okay? So she lets them out by a rope. They go out. She tells them, verse 16, to go hide up in the hill country, okay? Now, think geography for a second. We're at Jericho, okay? Jericho is just on the other side of the Jordan. It's at the base of the foothills. So if you think Fresno, this is like Northeast Clovis, like where you're still in the valley, but you're right on the base of the foothills, okay? To the west, then, is what? West of Jericho are the foothills, right? East is what? Jordan River, okay? So just to get your mind around it. So where does she tell them to go? West, the wrong way. So don't go home, okay? Don't go the way they think you're going to go. Go up into the foothills, go hide in all the caves that are up in there. Stay there for 3 days. Once the coast is clear, then head back, okay? So that's the idea. So now that you guys have a bit of an idea of the terrain, okay, this is the same route, by the way, or a similar route that would have been taken from Jerusalem to Jericho, this parable of the Good Samaritan. Plenty of great places to hide, okay? So this is foothills. This is pretty rough terrain. This is the mountainous area of Judah, and lots of places that they can just go bunker up for a couple days and hide, okay? And that's exactly what they do, okay? They give her a sign that we see in verse 17 and 18. This is what the spies asked for her to demonstrate her faith externally. Okay, so she's basically commanded to give the spies and the people that come into land an external sign that she is going to stick by her word and that she is still believing what she said she believed before. Okay, so if 11, 12, 13 is kind of her conversion process, if you will, and again, this story isn't meant to be necessarily her like coming to Christ or what have you, but the parallels are interesting. Okay, so she confesses her belief in the first couple of verses. What would you liken this part to? What is she called to do now? Does her faith remain private? No. What does she have to do? Act on it or demonstrate that. What maybe? How would you liken that? Or what parallels do we have in our faith today that we're you publicly display of? Yeah, it's similar to that, right? Your faith is intensely personal, but it's not private. And you're going to have to demonstrate to everyone around you, in a sense, that you believe this in an external way, okay? And it's obviously different, but she has to show via this red thing that she's going to put on a rope out of her window, or this scarlet, what do they call it? A red cord that she's going to put in her window, that she still believes what she believes, A, that she hasn't told anyone where the spies are, and that she still believes, and that's the place to save when we come back into town, and like, don't hit that with our, you know, with our Scud missiles or whatever, okay? I don't think they have those yet, okay? But yeah, that's the idea, okay? So fascinating, okay? And they make this agreement, okay? And she's going to stand by it, and we're going to see when she comes back, when they come back into the land, Rahab is going to have gathered all of her family. She's going to display the red cord, and that faith that she has is going to extend out to her family, and she's going to end up saving all of them because of this belief that she has in the God of Israel and the people of Israel, okay? So pretty cool. Now the spies return, so they go up to the hill country for 3 days. They come out, they escape. We find that in 12 and following. And this is the report that they bring back to Joshua. How about this? 24, last verse of chapter 2. Yes, please.
I just read a note in my Bible that said that the scarlet cord is similar to the cloak. That
Well, they're about to celebrate Passover. Could be, yeah. It's interesting that it's red. Maybe. I mean, there's some cool parallels there. They're like days from celebrating Passover. So
it would be like the Israelites Passover her.
Absolutely, right? And it's, right, instead of putting the blood on the lintels at the doorpost, she's putting a scarlet thread at our window. So, yeah, I mean, I wonder if that's where they tied that in. So, yeah. I mean, the parallels are pretty clear in terms of the picture of salvation that's happening with Rahab, right? So I think we'll meet her in heaven, right? She seems to be a believer in the God of Israel. So, yeah, that's quite likely. I like that. Good tie-in. Okay? So, chapter 3. Okay, let's see now. Now they're going to cross over the Jordan River, and they're going to enter the land for the first time. Yeah.
You said verse 24.
Oh, I'm sorry. Read 24 first. I thought we did that. My bad.
And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us."
Cool. So what's the response of the two spies? This is the response that Joshua wanted, right? Faith, confidence, okay? All the same people that were in the land when they went out and spied it out 40 years ago were still there, right? Nothing changed. These guys just have faith, and they realize, holy cow, God has set the table. These people are wigging out. They're running around with their tails between their legs, freaking out because they've heard the stories of our God. Let's go. Okay, so exactly what Joshua wanted to hear. Now, keep that in mind. Joshua sends out two spies. How did it go? Really well. Okay, Joshua's going to go, okay, I'm going to tuck that right away. That worked well. Okay. And that's going to get him in trouble in a minute, okay? So, chapter 3. Joshua rises early in the morning, sets out from Shittim, from the Jordan. They lodge there before they cross. So again, Shittim is on the east side of the Jordan. This is kind of their temporary lodging place, and now they're getting ready to cross, okay? Verse 2 came about at the end of 3 days. Remember, Joshua said, 3 days, we're going. So get ready. We're doing it, okay? He goes through the camp, and he says in verse 3, "When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, your God, with the Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from there and go after it." So what's going to lead them into battle? How do you like that? Okay, look at verse 4. He tells the people, the ark's going first, and here's how far in front of us it's going. You guys see that distance mentioned? 2,000 cubits, that's a half a mile, okay? So hey, white linen wearing dudes, you go up there, carry the ark, and there's going to be no one around you for a half a mile, okay? So you have some confidence as a Levite, like God better be on your side because you're marching into death with a box. Like you have no offensive weapons. You've got what you hope to be the physical representation of God, and everyone else is behind you going, you know, so they're really far away so they can see him, right? Okay, there it is. It's moving. Okay, let's go. So now as a pagan nation, what's the first thing that you see coming? Here's their God marching into the land, right? Like, dang. So, this is right. I mean, it's great. But boy, this took some faith on every side, right? For the priest to go, okay, you know, if they got guys sitting in towers with, you know, bows and arrows, which is they're going into lands that are higher than theirs. They're clearly in the worst strategic spot. They have the low ground. The people that they're going to go battle have the high ground, you know, dead, right? It'd be as easy as that. Okay. But that's how God told them to do. Okay. So half a mile in front. Okay, verse 5, he tells them to consecrate themselves, meaning get your hearts right, get ready for this event. Take up the Ark of the Covenant, verse 6, and cross over ahead of the people. Okay, so that's the plan. Let's see. He gives them some really cool instructions. Sorry, I'm trying to skip this a bit. Okay, look at verse 10. God's going to give them an illustration of what this crossing is going to mean for them. Okay, so as you go through, you're going to know that God's going to win this battle. All the ites are going to get defeated, okay? And then he tells them in verse 12, I don't want to forget this, so here's what he does.
"Now therefore, take 12 men from the tribe of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth, shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in the..."
So Those priests go first. They go stand in the middle of the Jordan. And when their feet hit the waters separate, just like the Red Sea. They will literally stand in a heap. The water is going to be coming downstream at them, and it's just going to stop. And they're going to cross, just like the Red Sea, on dry ground. And those priests are going to stand in the middle of the Jordan while everyone else goes through. They're going to be first in and last out. Okay? And he tells them, when they go in, let's see, where is it? Anyway, you get more of the details of that. The time of year that they cross, by the way, verse 15, notice what time of year it is. For the Jordan overflows its banks all the days of harvest. So they're crossing at harvest. So they're picking, in a sense, the worst time to cross. Okay, this would be likened to saying, this is after the snow melt in Fresno, when the rivers are as raging as they're going to be in the midst of a drought, right? But you pick the time where God says, okay, let's stack the deck against myself. Let's make the rivers super wide, okay? And that's when we're going to cross so everyone's really sure that it's a miracle. That's when they cross, okay? Now, as the priests are in the water now, Joshua gives this command in chapter 4, verse 2. This is what they're going to do while they cross.
Take 12 men from the people, from each tribe and man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in the place where you lodge tonight.
All right, so what are they doing, and who's doing it? What are they getting out of the Jordan? 12 stones, right? Okay. Apparently, these aren't like, you know, small rocks. He says, throw them up on your shoulders, and you're going to carry them out, okay? And who's getting those? So a leader from each tribe, because the idea is obviously each tribe is represented with a stone. So you take what was in the Jordan, okay, and you take it out of the Jordan, okay? Joshua calls the men over, verse 12, tells them to do this. Verse 5, cross again the ark of the Lord your God in the middle of the Jordan. Each of you take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of tribes of Israel. Verse 6, here's what this is to mean, okay? 6 and 7, your first Sunday school lesson in the Bible. So what is Joshua doing?
He's creating like a marker.
Absolutely. He's stopping in the midst of this, right, and making a marked moment. Okay, because what does he know is going to happen in years and years and years to come down the road? They're going to forget, right? Just like they probably did at the Red Sea. That's been 40 years. Joshua probably has that on his mind. He's 80. There's probably people going, we don't remember that. Like, my dad took me across on his back. I was 2 months old. No idea what you're talking about. And they forget. So he says, take the stones out of the Jordan, set them up, make a memorial, so that while you and your son are out for a walk one morning and you pass by the stones and your son says, what are those? Then you say, you know what that is? Let me tell you the story. This is a story. This is a monument to God's faithfulness in my life. Here's what he did. It's a physical reminder of an event that God does.
Is it just like the men right now, or is it everybody?
It's just the men. So 12 guys, so ahead of each tribe. So there's only 12 stones total, okay? So this isn't some gigantic heap, right? It would probably fit on a table, right? So a stone that they could carry, I mean, it had to be reasonably light, but, you know, the size maybe of a bowling ball, 12 of those. It's just a small rock pile. It's not impressive, right, in size or stature, but it's a reminder of them, right? What is the brilliance in this for Joshua? What do we so often fail to do in our lives when God gives us great victories? Give him credit, and then stop in a way that we can tangibly remember it, right? This lesson is great even today, right? It may not be a rock pile, but when God has demonstrated great faithfulness to you, do you write those things down? Do you draw a picture? Do you find some way to capture that in a way for you when in 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years, when it's difficult again, that you can go find that file and go, Lord, I remember when you were faithful here, so you can be faithful here. It's so easy to forget those things and just to pass by and to forget the dread that was happening inside of us and the life circumstances and the, right? It's like, oh yeah, we're through that and we've moved on and I'm no longer worried about that. So it's in the past. But boy, that is so, that's what gives us hope now, is to see what God has done in the past. And that's where God continues to take Israel to remind them, remember the things that I have done, and that will give you hope to trust me in the future, right? So you panicked and wigged out here. Don't do that again, right? Remember that I took care of you, so that next time when I put you in difficulty, you won't forget how I responded then and that I'm in control, okay? So it's a beautiful picture, and it's literally Joshua is trying to make sure that the next generation does not forget God, which is exactly what happens, right? So the parents ended up doing a crummy job of discipling their kids, which is why we have the book again of Judges, okay? Now, it doesn't stop there, okay? This lesson is bigger, okay? It's not just God took stones out of the Jordan. He's now going to command them to do something which sounds really weird. Look at verse 9. Okay, so not only does God say, get stones that were in the Jordan and take them out, he says, take stones that were out of the Jordan and put them in the middle of the Jordan River, okay, which currently is dry, but what's going to happen in like 20 minutes when the priests come out? You can't even see them, right? They're going to get covered with water. They're at the bottom of the Jordan. They're gone. Why is Joshua doing this? What's the picture? It's a replacement, right? This is penal substitution. It's substitutionary atonement. What should have been dead, by the way, what does Jordan mean? Judgment. The river of judgment. What was in that should have been judged came out. What was not judged, or what should not have been judged, went in and got judged. It was replaced. These rocks were a replacement of one another. What should not have died, died. What should have died, lived. Does that sound familiar? Okay, so God is using this as an illustration to talk about grace, talk about chesed, to talk about his character, talk about this idea of replacement, that one would come on behalf of another. So dads would tell their kids, just like the lamb that died in your place, we should have died in those waters. We shouldn't have made it through, but God made a way for us, right? And again, these kids wouldn't be able to see the rocks in there, but the dad would be able to say, you see these rocks here, which you can't see are these rocks that used to be in Gilgal, which we're camping now, but those are now in the midst of the Jordan. They were judged on our behalf so that we could have this land or whatever it may be. But you see Joshua just stop, okay? And we're going to see this several times throughout Scripture when God commands them to make an altar, if you will, a positive stone of remembrance. This is going to happen one time in the book where Joshua thinks it's an altar. The people stop and make an altar to God's faithfulness, just like they learned from Joshua. Joshua thinks it's an altar to worship pagan gods. Joshua comes out like with his sword drawn, and people are like, wait, time out. This is not a pagan altar. We're not going to worship Baal. This is an altar to remind us, just like you told us, of God's faithfulness. So these altars kind of get, you know, you're not really sure. Like, are you worshiping Baal there, or is it a celebration of God there, or a little of both, or whatever? So anyway, you see this idea commanded from God. So I think the great takeaway for us is to do that, right? I have on my shelf at home in my office a stone, a rock from everywhere we went in Israel. And it doesn't mean a lot to anyone that walks in and sees it, but they're free, right? So I grabbed one and just wrote Jordan River, right? This is where I got to baptize so-and-so. And I took this from the Elah Brook, where David took a rock to slay Goliath. I took this from this, right? And they're all over the place. And each one of those rocks tells a different story. Some are very positive. Some are very negative. Reminders to me of, boy, this is what Israel did. And boy, God put their hands on a chalkboard and spanked them. And there are other times that they did great. And this is a reminder of God's faithfulness, or whatever it may be. Okay. So when we go to Israel, bring you a big fat Ziploc bag, and your bag's going to be about 5 pounds heavier than it came, because you're going to have it full of rocks. And bring a Sharpie, and you're going to label them, right? And they're just fun, great souvenirs to give, and great reminders for you guys of, I stood there, I saw this. This is what God did here. He taught the Israelites this lesson, and this is the lesson, or whatever it may be, okay? So keep that in the back of your head, okay? So that's a lot of fun, all right? So, cool exchange of rocks, okay? We see in 10 and following that the Reubenites, verse 12, really Reuben, the sons of Gad, the half-tribe of Manasseh, cross over in battle array before the sons of Israel, just as Moses had spoken. So these guys step up, they come across wielding their shields and swords or whatever they happen to have at the time, 40,000 of them in verse 13, and they come. So they obey, which is really, really cool. Okay, and we see verse 14, kind of the complete picture of this transfer of leadership with Joshua. This is the people's attitudes toward him. Read that, 4:14. So pretty cool, right? Completely different leader, okay? Moses had about him a very in tune spiritual sense with God. You're going to see that Joshua is not that guy. Joshua is a bulldog, ears pinned back, ready to fight, okay? So he's got savvy, he's a military guy. He is not a get on my knees and go have a quiet time with God type of guy. Not that he didn't have that, but that wasn't who his fiber was, okay? These people respect him. He has a different job to do, and the people are like, absolutely, we'll follow that guy. That's God's man, okay? So cool to see that transfer happen, okay? So look, it's verse 19. Jane, speaking of Passover, read that.
On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal at the eastern border of Jericho.
Okay, so 10th day of the first month. You guys remember what the 10th day of the first month was? Lamb Selection Day. Okay, so that means in 5 days, Passover's coming, right? They're about to celebrate Passover, okay? So pretty cool, okay? 12 stones get taken up from Gilgal. They put them in the water just as Joshua had commanded, okay? And they're getting ready to cross. Now, they're now across the waters, right? The waters have parted. God brings them across on dry land, not emphasize that. So that miracle has happened. It's amazing. They are right outside of now Jericho, which is, again, right on the foothills, but it's the first battle that they have to now go feat. There is no natural boundary between the enemy and them. They had the Jordan before, right, that nobody was coming across. You're not just going to start swimming across the Jordan and do battle. So they were safe, okay? They're not safe anymore. They are sitting inside the Jordan within eyeshot of the enemy, okay? Chapter 5 in that context makes zero sense, okay? Watch what God does. This is insane, okay? 5:1.
As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there was no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel.
All right, now think about this from a military standpoint. If you had heard this is the condition of your enemy, what are you going to do next? What's the condition of the people, the enemies right now? They're sitting ducks, right? They are freaking out. Not only have they heard about the Red Sea and Sihon and Og and all the battles between, what just happened yesterday? The Jordan River parted and the people came through. Are you freaking kidding me, right? 2 to 3 million people just walked across the river on dry land, right? Here comes this box with white dudes holding it and the river parts. They've never seen this. And the people are literally wigging out. If you're Joshua, a military guy, what is your next command? Go get everybody. They're laying there for the taking, right? These people are literally sitting ducks, and this is like taking candy from a baby. Thank you. Just give me your stuff, and you can move on, okay? There's the exit. Go across the Jordan to be gone, okay? That is not at all what God does, okay? Verse 2.
Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time.
I'm sorry, what? Take flint knives and let's go ahead and circumcise everybody a second time, okay? Now, let's be clear on what that means, okay? We'll explain it here, okay? Verse 4, we'll talk about what happens, but this is what the second time means. It doesn't actually mean we're going to circumcise the same dude twice, okay? Read verse 4. We'll let a girl read that.
And this is the reason why Joshua circumcised them. All the males of the people who came out of Egypt, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness on the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out had been circumcised, yet all the people who were born on the way in the wilderness after they had come out of Egypt had not been circumcised.
All right, so we got a whole generation that believes in God, but they just hadn't had the opportunity for whatever reason to get circumcised, okay? Now, mind you, when does God command circumcision in the scriptures? Eighth day, okay? It's slightly painful, okay? This is not something that you want to volunteer to do as an adult, okay? So forgive me for being graphic, but I mean, think back for a little bit to Shechem. You guys remember that story? And Hamor, okay? And Dinah, and that whole story of, hey, you can marry our daughters. And Levi and Simeon, what do they have all the males that are underneath Shechem or in the town of Shechem underneath the king Hamor do? They get circumcised. And what happens to those guys? Right? It's Ice Bag and Oprah for 3 days. You're done. Okay? So they're going to go in and they killed everybody. Right? So two guys kill an entire city. Okay? So that's what happens here. Right? That's the idea. So you're going to take every fighting male and you're going to circumcise them, which means they're out of commission for 3 days. So you're unprotected. You've got women, you've got children, and everyone's getting circumcised. While your neighbors are right there, your enemies, they're watching you. There's no barrier in between you. You're sitting ducks now. So this makes, why would God do this? This makes no logical sense. What's that? Because he's stacking the deck. Exactly, right? That's the idea. Okay, what else is he teaching the Israelites in this moment? Trust, right? Does this make sense? Nope. The way I operate often doesn't. You should think naturally that God's next step would say, they're ripe for the picking. I put them on a silver platter for you. Just go ask them for their, you know, their jewelry and their cowflon and whatever, and they're going to leave. God says, nope, you're going to trust me. Why, by the way, was circumcision such a big deal for God? What was the picture? It's a sign of what? Of belief in the covenant or belief in the relationship with him. He says, so before you can go in and take the land, you have to identify yourselves with me. And until you have done that, until you made that distinction, I'm not going to let you have the land, okay? So that's exactly what they do, okay? Verse 2, at that time, the Lord says, do this. Verse 3, so Joshua made himself a flint knife, which by the way, okay, flint is a rock in Israel. So you're taking a rock and you're making essentially an arrowhead out of it or a knife. So you could create a sharp edge on a rock, just like, you know, Native Americans would do. That's the concept. And you're going to call every guy over and... Okay, so, I mean, this is not a, it's not super hygienic. This isn't like, here's some Novocaine. This is a bad deal, okay? There is no general anesthesia. It's rough, okay? And he circumcised the sons of Israel at Gibeoth Haraloth, okay? So all the men of Israel get circumcised. What's that, Jane?
Did anybody die from this? Mm-mm.
We don't hear of anybody. This is... I guess a supernatural deal, but yeah, you would think that this isn't like a sterile OR, right? So, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, lots of thoughts. Yeah. So I would imagine that Joshua probably had some help, but yeah. So you've got every guy down for a matter of days, okay? Anyway, so fascinating. So what is your faith level like as a, how about a dad? Just think about that, okay? You're... Some dude in Judah, you got 3 kids and a wife, and you're going to go fight tomorrow. So you think. And God says, get circumcised. Like, I'm leaving my family completely unprotected? Are you kidding me? Like, no, I'm not doing that. That's dumb. God says, yep, that's exactly what you're going to do. And you're going to lay here on a cot and get well, and when I'm ready, we'll go fight. I'll take care of your family. Like, but dude, Jericho's right there. Like, what if the king of Jericho decides, we're going to be on the offensive, we're going to go attack them first? They're hosed. But... that's how God works. So, again, great learning lesson for Israel. Like, you've got to trust me, okay? So they all get circumcised. You kind of hear the backstory as to why, all kind of through 6 and 7 and following. Verse 9, it says, the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you, okay? It happens at this place called Gilgal, okay? This is the town that they've now set up shop in on the other side, on the west side of the Jordan, okay? Gilgal, by the way, for the next number of years is going to be home base for Israel. So they're going to go out on a raid and an attack a place, and they're going to come back to Gilgal, okay? So this will be kind of their shop. So just west side of the Jordan, it's right by Jericho, okay? Just slightly northeast of it, if you will, but they're right next to each other. And God says, I've rolled away the reproach. What does that mean, that he's rolled away the reproach?
Removed it.
Yeah, in a sense. But why was Israel a reproach to God up until this point? Yeah, because we got, 1.5 million dudes that haven't been circumcised, that haven't identified their trust in the covenant relationship with God. So he does this. And in verse 10, while Israel is healing, what do they do in 10? Yeah, they observe Passover. How cool is that, right? Anything you'd like to share, Layla?
The place where they all got circumcised, it says that it means the hill of the foreskin. So gross.
Yikes. It's odd when we get into Judges. That's.
It was another marker.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Indeed. It's odd, like, you think about that, right? You guys remember the story of Samson and what his buddies require him to go get? Like, he has to go get the foreskins of however many Philistines. You're like, that's awkward, right? So, okay, so there you go. Right? So that's, yeah, it's a strange deal, but you guys get the faith thing behind it, I think in our context, obviously makes a lot of sense, okay? Check out, by the way, what happens in verse 12. This is cool. I've never seen this.
The day after they ate of the produce of the land, and there was no longer manna for the people of Israel, but they ate of the fruit of the land of Canaan that year.
How cool is that? Like, they woke up one morning and the manna's gone. You're like, dang, we've been doing this for 40 years. Like, what do? Eat, right? God told them, when you walk into this land, you're going to eat of stuff that you didn't plant, you're going to enjoy wells that you didn't dig, and they start eating of the land. Does God, by the way, change how he operates sometimes? For 40 years he did this, and all of a sudden tomorrow he does this? Absolutely, right? If you get stuck in that groove that God is like this all the time, God's going to show Joshua specifically in battle, I do not operate the same way every time. Trust me. Yesterday it was manna, today it's grapes. Tomorrow it may be, who knows, but trust me.
So all these people have only ever eaten manna, right? So how do they know how to eat food?
Exactly. I mean, think about that. You're 40 years old and you've never... Or maybe some of them are older than this. So anyone under 20. This could be a 60-year-old whose diet has been manna his entire life. And he's walking in the land. He's never even seen a grape or a zucchini or a cucumber or, right? None of this. So God's like, okay. So they're going to figure it out. So I can imagine when you're hungry enough, you'll figure out, poison ivy. Oh, wait, that was bad. So probably didn't have poison ivy, but yeah. Yeah, this is true. The quail from the ocean, right? That was good while they were at the table and not so good afterwards. So, yeah.
Okay, so I have a question about the names of these places. So, is it already called that, or did they establish the name? Because, I mean, all over my notes of
yeah.
the bottom are talking about, like, and this sounds like Hebrew for...
Yeah. You're going to see both. And we don't always see the distinction. They'll rename a city and say, it used to be called Luz. Now we're going to call it Bethel because it's the house of God. Jacob was in Luz, but he says, I'm going to rename this place for what it means to me, which is the house of God, because this is where God showed up for me. Some of that may be like they renamed it Gilgal because this is where our reproach was taken away by God because now we believe in him. But there's people that have lived in the city and these places for, at this point, thousands of years that are already there, and their cities in their place. So some of these are going to stay. Some of them are going to change. We're going to see Jerusalem get renamed to Jerusalem. It was named several things before that. People name it after their gods or what have you. But so it's a little of both. So, and as we see those, you can kind of call them out in the midst of our time together. Okay, so manna ceases, and now they're going to eat real food. Okay, so God shut down that system. Okay, so 13 and following, this is kind of a private lesson just for Joshua, 13 through 15. You've heard this story, no doubt, in Sunday school, but kind of a cool one.
When Joshua was by Jericho, he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man was standing before him with his drawn sword in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, are you for us or... or for our adversaries.
So Joshua's probably out surveying the land. He's doing what a good military guy should do, and he's looking at what they're about to go do, right? So he's just circumcised everybody, and he's checking out Jericho. And he sees a guy, sword in hand, and what's his first question to this dude? Are you for us or against us? Meaning, what's Joshua asking? Am I going to kill you or let you live? I mean, that he's you see Joshua's mentality? Like, he's a military guy. He is not scared. Like, are you shirts or skins? Because I need to know right now, because you're about to go down, right? Crips or Bloods, I need to know you're going to die, okay? You better be on the right team, okay? And he gets a fascinating answer.
And he said, no, but I am the commander of the army of the Lord. Now I have come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant?
So who does Joshua recognize this guy to be? This is an angel of some sort who identifies himself as captain of the host of the Lord. So captain of the armies of the Lord, I'm that guy, okay? Tony Evans, who is a, if you guys ever listen to Tony Evans, oh, you guys need to, okay? Phenomenal pastor, DTS grad, where Brad and I and Shay and other guys went to seminary. He can bring it. I mean, just biblically measured guy. Nobody can preach like an African-American. This guy is just, right? And I heard him teach this one day. We went to his church out in Oak Cliff, so he's in this like really hard part of Dallas, and he just brought it. And the way that Tony, I won't even try to attempt his voice, but he's got this chest that's like this big, right? Like, he can speak to 4,000 people without a microphone, and you're like, yep, got it, right? But he said, Angel of the Lord says, I didn't come to take sides, I came to take over, basically. Like, you need to get your mind right, Joshua. I am your boss. And Joshua immediately realizes this, falls on his face, worships him. So you get the idea that we see this response for angels as well in Scripture. But when an angel is worshipped, what is their general response?
Don't do that.
This guy doesn't say, don't do that, right? He says, you have understood correctly who I am, right? So Joshua falls on his face. What is my Lord to say of his servant? That's Joshua's response. So who would you suppose this guy is? Yeah, this is the angel of the Lord. This is the pre-incarnate Christ. Okay, this is Jesus before Jesus. Okay, so the captain of the Lord's host said to Joshua, remove your sandals from your feet, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. So the idea being, what's about to occur here is going to blow your mind. So take your sandals off. This interaction with me and what I'm about to do for you is going to blow your mind. Okay, so pretty cool little story. And I think it just puts Joshua's mind in the right spot as a leader, helps him recognize what God's about to do and the significance of these battles that are about to take place. And a good reminder for Joshua, what have we seen as his core, like on a bad day, what does he wrestle with? Being afraid, right? What do you think this interaction did for him? Yeah, it probably buoyed his faith in a way that he desperately needed, right? He walks across the land. He does his job. Okay, God, I circumcised all the people. This, by the way, was stupid. If we want to talk about military, God, this was not a really good idea. So he's standing there alone, having been faithful, probably having a really, really real conversation with God. What was this about? And he meets this guy and God says, calm down, okay? Why don't you bow and worship me? I got this handled. Relax. Okay, so I would guess at that moment God knew where Joshua was and needed his faith just pumped up a little bit. Okay, so chapter 6 now, this is the first battle. We have been preparing for 5 chapters to conquer the land. Now we're going to start conquering the land. And Jericho is our first battle that we're going to fight. Okay, this one gets a ton of press because it's really cool. The rest of them are kind of, they're all different, but none of them get kind of the front page headlines like this one does, okay? So 6 verse 1, let's kind of continue on there. So of the type of cities that you're going to go fight against, Jericho's bad, right? I mean, they're good bad. Okay, or bad, depending on if you're Israel, okay? This is a fortified city. You do not want to screw with Jericho, okay? So that's the idea, okay? This is what God says, verse 2.
And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor.
Valiant?
You
shall you do for 6 days?
Okay, so notice, by the way, verse 2, I love this about God. How does he speak about this battle? Past tense or present? It's past. It's already happened. Like, I have given. It's already occurred, but it hasn't occurred yet. It's a future event, but it's already done. Now, you have to be obedient. I'm going to open a door. You got to walk through it, okay? But it's done. I've already done it, right? So, speaking of whoever's Facebook post, maybe it was Tony's yesterday, about just the whole idea of predestination. God has already done it. We still have a responsibility in the midst of that, but it's done. So Joshua is told by God, this battle is finished. It's over. Now, I'm not just going to allow this to happen any such way. There is an order and a process that I have deemed appropriate that you're going to walk through. And it's crazy. 6 days, you're going to walk around the city once every day. Seventh day, you're going to walk around 6 times, okay? So you're going to walk around the city 7 times. You're going to walk around a total of 13 times around the city, okay? Okay, again, militarily, you're like, what?
So the women and children are just kind of hanging out watching, but they're there with them.
They're in Gilgal.
Okay.
So they're like, they're right there, marching around the city. So, but the men of war are marching around the city.
Would that be 12 times?
6 days and 6 times on the 7th day?
7 times on the 7th day, I think. So it's 6 days in a row, once a day, so that's 6. On the last day, it's 7 times, so 13, I think.
Yeah.
So when it's a Bible trivia, when you ask how many times you march around Jericho, everyone's going to say 7. And you say, take that, it's 13, give me your money. So, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, we bet on these things in our house, absolutely. That's how I make money. I don't get allowance. My kids get allowance. I take their allowance. My wife doesn't give me no monies. So I get it. I steal from my kids. Early. I didn't sleep very well last night. Can you tell, Mark? I'm sorry. Yeah, it's going to be one of those days. So, yeah, it's bad. Anyway, my bad. All right, so 6 days. Seventh day, they're going to march around 7 times. Okay, verse 4. This is really cool. Okay, now put your... You're going to have to be astute to get why this is. But what's going on here in verse 4? Keep going.
When you hear them sound a long blast on the trumpets, have all the people give a loud shout. Then the wall of the city will collapse and the people will go up, every man straight in.
Okay. So last day, priests are going to go out. They're going to blow a shofar, a ram's horn. Okay? And then what are they going to do?
Shout.
They're going to shout. And then what ultimately is the end result? What is Israel going to get?
The city.
The land. So they're going to get their first portion of land, okay? Why did God do it this way? What's significant about land and a ram's horn? Think Leviticus. Anybody? What happened every 50 years in Israel? What did you do to the monopoly board?
Oh.
You dumped it. And the land went back to its rightful owner. And that started by the blowing of a shofar. So God has the priest come in, blow the shofar, and say, we're going to take what's rightfully ours. We're dumping the monopoly board. We're coming in. Okay, so just kind of a cool picture that the Israelites who would have been in the desert and learned these laws then, there would have been some symbolism for them to understand, okay, God is giving us what's already ours because it's his, and he's giving it now to us, his loved ones. Okay, so... that's exactly what they do, okay? Verse 6, Joshua says, take up the Ark of the Covenant, let the 7 priests carry 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord, okay? Verse 7, now they're going to start marching, okay? So they go in, and then they're going to get some marching orders, okay? Verse 10, this is how they march. Okay, so on the last day, God's going to say, shout, okay? But here's the picture, okay? So they're all in Gilgal. The men leave the city, all the men in battle array. So whatever battle attire that they have, they're going out to fight in. And they march around the city in complete silence, once around and home. Next day, once around, home. Once around, home. Now, for those of you guys that have been in a locker room, there's no women present, there's no children present. What would you suppose is happening from the enemy as they're standing on the walls of Jericho watching these guys march around their city? You think they're taunting them a little bit? Totally, right? Talking about their mother and, right, and whatever. I mean, you can just imagine the inappropriate comments that are coming out of here, right? And what are the Israelites required to do? Silence. Okay? So you've got these guys that are smack-talking, popping off. Like, they come in the first day, the people are probably wigging out, right? They're ready for a battle. They're scared. After a couple days of that, they're probably laughing at them, right? These guys, like, they're realizing, you don't have any swords. You got plowshares. Where are your shields? You guys don't look like an army. You look like a bunch of people have been walking through the desert for 40 years. Like, you need some water in a bed. Like, y'all look tired, right, and haggard and sunburnt. You don't look like warriors. So you can just imagine, and they're required just to sit there and take it and shut up, right? Fascinating picture. And I want to imagine after a few more days, after they've done that enough, that probably became even more and more intimidating. The confidence that these people would have demonstrated to say, we don't even need to respond. Our God's going to do the work. We don't even need to talk about your mom in response or whatever, right? We can just keep our cool. So that had to be kind of a weird, like, I would imagine initially the Jerichoites, whatever they are, would have felt a sense of confidence. And then I would imagine by the end of it, they're thinking, this is weird. This is kind of wigging us out a little bit. So they've done this for 6 days in a row now.
Did we already talk about how big around
the city is? No. In Jericho, I don't know. If you take like a typical city in Israel, like a tel, so all cities that were worth being fortified were built up on what it's called a tel, okay? And we'll study these more as we get through this our study of Israel stuff. It's a raised hill, and civilization after civilization would have been built on top of one another, so ultimately that place is raised, okay? So that's location, location, location. So that's where you would rebuild, okay? Same in Israel, same for everybody, okay? Food, water, shelter, it's the same for everybody. Food, water, defensible location is what you look for in a city, okay? You're probably looking at an area of, like one of the cities, Lachish, which is one of the gateway cities, you're probably looking at an area of 20 acres, okay, in terms of size of the city. So we're not talking about Fresno, okay? We're talking about something that you could walk around in 30 minutes, 45 minutes, okay? Slowly, intentionally, just at a walking pace, walk around the city and go back, okay? So, but enough to house a lot of people and supplies. Lachish housed food and water for all their residents for a year, okay? So they had enough. So it's, I mean, it's a big city. That's significant in their day, okay? So to put in your mind, and I forget how many, a football field is like 3 acres, is that right? I think that's right. Anyway, I need to research that. Anyway, but I think that's about right. So 20 acres plus or minus, that's probably Jericho-ish. I need to go research that before you write that down in your Bible, but okay.
Did anybody else watch the VeggieTales? Every time I do this, I'm always like, you silly little
Vicar! Do they have, there's some good theology in those. If you guys, yeah. You either have to have kids or worked in Kids Connection at some point, but yeah, the VeggieTales in these are great, so yeah. And then the songs are in my head that, yeah, so anyway, okay. Yeah, they're funny. Go find them from some parent. So
that's my favorite one.
They're good.
Josh.
Yeah, Josh.
My Bible says it's about 10 acres.
10? Well, that's probably more right than me, so, okay. So decent-sized city regardless, okay. All right, so seven times around, verse 13, seven priests carrying seven ram's horns. For the ark of the Lord went on continually, they blew the trumpets, and the armed men went before the Lord, and the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord while they continued to blow the trumpets, okay? Second day, marched around the city, so they did this over and over and over, verse 14, for 6 days, okay? 15, let's watch now what happens.
On the seventh day, they rose early at the dawn of day and marched around the city in the same manner seven times. It was only on that day that they marched around the city seven times.
So this would have taken the better part of, like, the morning, right? And so probably the lunch, if not further on.
And at the seventh time, when the priests had blown the trumpets, Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city. And the city and all of that, and the city and all that is within it shall be delivered to the Lord for destruction. Only Rahab the prostitute and all who are with her in her house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent, but you keep yourselves from the things devoted to destruction, lest you have devoted them to take any of the devoted things and make the camp of Israel a thing for destruction and bring trouble upon it.
All right, so seventh day, they're going to march. You guys know the story. Okay, they're going to blow the ram's horns. The walls are going to fall down. What's to happen with the city, 17 and 18? What does it mean it's under the ban? They're going to destroy almost everything, okay? They're going to take some stuff, and we're going to find out that their treasures and such are going to be put into, basically, the tabernacle. These are going to be for the future temple, but they're going to take the bounty, okay? But who gets it? The Lord, right? This is, so what do you call it? What is this pictorially? What is God saying? The first battle is all mine. You get nothing. Yeah, this is first fruits. You're going to tithe this to me, okay? So don't covet anything in here, lest you bring, and this is cool, 18, remember this word, trouble on it, okay? Israel accursed and bring trouble upon Israel, okay? So take everything you get, burn the city, get rid of everything, take the stuff of value, which God tells them, and then you're going to put that in the tabernacle, and that's ultimately going to go to the worship of the Lord and those sorts of things, okay? Verse 19, silver, gold, bronze articles, and iron, the holy, they are holy for the Lord. They shall go in the Lord's treasury, okay? So, yep.
When he's saying he blew the trumpet, or the shofar, and then all the walls came down, and it's saying only Rahab and her family were living, did, like, everyone else just, like, die?
Some were, or people were killed by the Israelites. But, yeah, here's what's even... we don't get a ton on that, but yeah, you'll see a little bit about them burning the city. But yeah, the idea is that people died. Maybe some thought maybe an earthquake. But think about this. The walls fall down. Where's Rahab live? So that part of the wall doesn't fall down, right? So it's like God is gracious to that specific. So walls fall down. Apparently people die. And what they didn't, I guess the Israelites took care of. So, but we don't get a ton of details on that, okay? Yeah, so it's tough. I mean, here's your heart theology, y'all. I mean, this is kill everybody, okay? And we want to fight for this whole idea of the people are innocent. It's like, no, these people are not innocent. Nobody's innocent. So God says to kill them, and that's it's hard, but boy, that's the reality of it, okay? Verse 20, here's the seventh day, seventh lap. Priests blew the trumpets, went in, the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city, just like that. So God is faithful, 21, there you go, that's the verse, utterly destroyed everything in the city, man, woman, young, old, ox, sheep, donkey, with the edge of the sword, okay? So what was not killed in the falling of the walls, the Israelites do, okay? So that's your battle. So again, what's cool about this, if we made this, you know, as Americans and made a movie out of it, 21 would be like the whole movie, right? The battle and everything. We get more on how are we to blow the shofar? Like how many laps? How's that going to take? Right? That's the emphasis, because the emphasis isn't on the battle. It's on God and what he's going to do, okay? So 22 and following, Rahab is spared. They go into the harlot's house, bring out the woman. Her whole family is spared in verse 23. Her father, mother, brothers, all that had placed their faith in the words of Rahab at this point. So now, You take this to the next step. What has now Rahab gone out and done after her conversion? She's converted her whole family, right? Y'all don't know these guys, but I hid them in my house. Here's their God. You remember that God that did this and that and the other thing? Okay, their God is coming into our town, and it's all about to go south. Y'all need to get on my team. And they're all now converted as well, okay? So they are all spared. God keeps his word. Joshua keeps his word. Even though he wasn't there, the spies come back and say, hey, by the way, there's this gal, we need to save her, and Joshua's good to his word, okay? Now, 26, after this town is completely destroyed, this curse is uttered. Listen to this.
Joshua laid an oath on them at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds the city, Jericho. At the cost of his firstborn shall he lay its foundation, and at the cost of his youngest son, shall he set up its gate.
So what happens to the person who decides down the road, I'm going to rebuild this city, because it's a perfect location, right? Again, there's a reason why it was built here in the first place, and they're going to rebuild it in the future. What happens? You're going to lose your firstborn And your youngest. You're going to have two kids die if you want to rebuild this city. Okay. Now, Exodus is at 1446. We're 40-ish years later. So let's call it round number 1400 BC-ish, okay, when this happens. Something like that, okay? Turn to 1 Kings chapter 16. About 1400 BC. Okay, this is the reign of Ahab, okay? So just to kind of fast forward, Saul, David, Solomon, kingdom splits north and south, okay? 1 Kings 16. You've got southern and northern kings, okay? Ahab is one of the kings of Israel in the north. He is horrible, like the worst. You guys remember the gal Jezebel? Okay. Ahab is married to Jezebel. She's a freak show. Awful pagan. Like, let's worship every god we can, and then let's invent some new ones. She's horrible. Okay. So this guy's, man, he's a nightmare. So he's reigning in Israel. Verse 30, Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the sight of the Lord than all who were before them. That's not good when people say that about you. Like, there was people before you did evil, which, by the way, like, he comes from a line of a lot of evil. He upped the ante on evil, okay, and does even more, okay? Marries Jezebel, verse 31. Verse 32, he erects an altar to Baal, okay, in Samaria. So he's worshiping the wrong gods. And then 34, he gets an idea. Now, the kingdom splits in 931, okay? I forget how far down the line Ahab is time-wise, but we're talking probably 600 years later after Jericho fell originally. God said, whoever rebuilds this city, they're going to lose their kid. Hiel, or whatever this dude's name is Ahab's builder. This guy loses two kids for rebuilding the city because of the word of the Lord spoken by Joshua. So Ahab says, go rebuild it. This guy says, great, I'm going to rebuild it. He loses his first kids putting up the gates. And the second, according to the word of the Lord, whatever. Okay, so loses two kids as a result of that. Again, probably 600-ish years later. Okay, so insane. All right, so just as a note, God did not forget this promise. Okay, so. Yeah, not Ahab, but Ahab's builder, Hillel, the Bethelite. So, just again, fascinating. So, like, we have no, as Americans, like, we have no reference for 600 years. Our country's been around for, like, less than half that. We're trying, you know, 600 years. I doubt it. Man, the word of the Lord in that day was like, no. So, they were probably like, huh, that's weird. We lost one. Keep rebuilding. Oh, another one. We should probably stop. So, right? But no, that was probably forgotten. This guy is one of the most evil kings of Israel. Not the worst, but yeah, the worst one actually gets saved, which is weird.
That was 6,000 years later?
600. 600. Yeah. Yeah. Yep, yep, yep. So we'll stop there. Tomorrow, we will look at the rest of these battles in the south, and we'll start with battle number two. Okay? So... y'all have a great day. Enjoy, and we will see you bright and early in the manana.